Okay, I have 8 o'clock on my clock. And when you turn the lights on in my face, I just thought that ever since I got used to having many bright nimittas, I got also used to being in the spotlight. It's another advantage of getting nimittas in the mind, that you learn how to deal with the bright glows right in front of you. But the talk this morning, again, based on one of the questions somebody asked last night, and to make it useful for the practice of meditation, the rising of insight, somebody asked, does right view come before jhanas, or jhanas become before right view? How do all these things come together, and especially on views? Because you may have known and experienced for such a long time. However many Buddhists there are that many forms of Buddhism. Everyone has got their own idea and view of what is right and what is wrong. And that's why people keep arguing. And the arguments are always very, very unpleasant. And so there's many, many ways that we have in Buddhism to, at least at the very beginning, just to doubt one's own views, so that we can just not, at least, not have arguments. So one of the ways to do that in Bodhinyana Monastery, we have our two main rules for the monastery. And we try to enforce these rigorously because we're a very strict monastery. And the first rule is the abbot is always right. And the second rule is when he's wrong, go back to rule number one. And that means we don't have so many arguments. Otherwise, everybody has their view. The other thing which we have in monasteries, this is good for business as well, or in your family. If anyone has an idea, if anyone thinks, oh, I think we should build a hall, or we should build a path there, if it's their idea, they have to do it. We won't do it. Your idea, you do it. So if anyone has any ideas how to improve jhana growth, you're going to have to do it. Because what that really does is it's really easy to have ideas and views, but we don't really understand the consequences of those views. Yeah, it's a really good idea. But who's going to do it? Who's going to make it happen? Where are we going to get the funds from? Will it work? So this is one of the reasons why when we have a meditation retreat, our thoughts get less and less and less and less and less. Which means the ideas get less and less and less and less. Because how much more do you need? This place is comfortable. It's good enough. But you can always make it more. And that's what the restlessness does. The restlessness always wants to improve things. But it never appreciates what we already have. So we are moving away from that restlessness of improving things, improving yourself, improving jhana growth, improving Ajahn Brahm. Look, it's a waste of time. That person who put on the questions, when am I going to let go and not take condensed milk? Condensed milk, that's like concentrated milk. That's a seek for concentration. So you're not going to improve me, this is me, you're stuck with me, so I'm not going to improve at this age. So, instead of trying to improve things is what thoughts and views actually do. We are content with things, which means we don't have so many things to think about and argue. Have ever you noticed that all of your thoughts are always trying to improve things, criticize things? What we call the fault-finding mind. And there's something amazing that when you start to become peaceful, when you start to develop stillness, when you start getting close to jhana, you realize, actually, these things are really good as they are. Yeah, they could be better, but it's really beautiful. So in meditation, that's the time you could stop and enjoy things. And after meditation, then you go and work and you can improve things. But in meditation, you don't improve anything. Don't try and improve yourselves. Are you good enough? After 8 days of meditation, are you still trying to improve for the last day? Are you still trying to make progress? Look, it hasn't worked yet. It's not going to work. Your stuff, you're not going to get jhanas, you're not going to get enlightened. Come on, get honest. Get real. It's true, isn't it? So stop trying to improve yourself. So just be content. Have one day today of no jhana day. No trying to improve day. No trying to get anything day. Just be here and enjoy. You've worked really hard, so have about a bit of a rest before you go back to work. Because when you go back home to your family, to your work, to your monastery, you're going to have to work again. But now you don't have to, so please enjoy today. Your last day of freedom. Freedom from your kids, from your parents, from your in-laws. Freedom. Enjoy it. I said that on the last day because people think, oh God, only one day to go. I better get into it today. No more sleep, no more messing around. I'm really going to go for it today because I've done nothing all week. Don't do stupid things like that. All the time, I've been trying to encourage you, just don't try and improve this moment. Don't try and improve yourself. Don't try and improve the mind. That's what you do in the world. Just be. And if you give up all hope for jhanas, all hope for nimittas, then you've got a chance. At last. So, we're not trying to improve ourselves. And if you don't improve yourselves, that's what thoughts are always doing. Always thinking, I should do this, I should do that. Imagine all your thoughts were, oh, this is good enough. I'm good enough. The place is good enough. Ajahn Brahm is good enough. There's nothing much to think about then. Soon all your thoughts stop. And all your views come to a crunching halt. There's nothing else to do if there's no problems. That's one of the reasons why in newspapers they also always have to have the problems. Gives you something to think about. The good news will have nothing to think about. Imagine they had headlines on CNN. 60 meditators were in Jhana Grove this weekend. Would that be interesting? Not really, would it? There's no violence, no sex, no corruption. It's really boring. If there's more people like me around the world, there'll be no news outlets. But, but this is how we can get some peace and some happiness. So, but a lot of times that because people think too much and they assume that what they think about is right and true and justified, that's why we always argue with one another. And even Socrates, he worked out, and actually I worked this out as well, and when I read Socrates, I said, yeah, Socrates is smart. He agrees with me. Yeah, I'm a very humble monk. I always say I'm a humble monk. But I always mention, if you are humble, you must let people know about it. What's the point of being humble if no one knows? So, but anyway, what Socrates said and what I worked out, just a very simple logic, is you, whatever you say, whatever you think, you must always think is right. You can't think that you're wrong. It's impossible. You can't think that you are wrong. You can think you were wrong. But even if you think you were wrong, you're right about that. You're always right. So this has to be the case. If you really get your head around it, every thought you have, every time you speak, at that moment, at that time, you think you're right. But you can't be. So every time you actually have a thought, you have a speech, don't always, you know, insist it's right. That's one of the reasons why people have problems in their relationships, in their marriage. You know that old story about the nice girl? She always wanted to marry Mr. Right. And she finally found Mr. Right. He's always right. She can't say anything. Or to make it fair, there's the old joke. If a husband says something in the forest where there's no one there to listen to him, is he still wrong? That goes on. If a tree falls in a forest and no one sees it, is it still fallen? So why is it that everybody has to be right? And they have the nice little solution, which I've been saying in marriages. I'm saying this in Indonesia. It really got a lot of traction. People said, yeah, it's a great idea. In a marriage, you always have arguments. Everyone wants to be right. And there's a very, very simple solution called the calendar method. And the calendar method means if you're having an argument with the person you love and live with, don't try and prove who's right and who's wrong, because that's impossible. You'll never be able to prove, because everyone thinks they're right. So the only way to solve that problem, the calendar method, look at the day of the month. If it's an odd day of the month, the 1st, the 3rd, the 5th, the 7th, the 9th, the 11th, and so on, then she's right. If it's an even day of the month, then he's right. That way, the calendar says who's right and who's wrong, and it's fair, it's even, so you can live a happy, harmonious life. It stops people arguing. Now, sometimes people think that is a joke, and it's so simple it can't be real and helpful, but people are actually practicing that and it works. You know, it means in a marriage, you know, why does he always have to be right? Why does she always have to be right? You don't. It's fair, fair. Odd days, she's right. Even days, he's right. What day is it today?
Friday.
Yeah, but... she must be right. The 10th. You're wrong. Girls are wrong today because it's an even day. The boys are right. And it settles the matter once and for all. But, you know, tomorrow you're right, so it's fair, fair. Because otherwise, all the views tend to arguments. And even within Buddhist circles, you know, we're arguing which is the best part of Buddhism. Even just not even the best type of Buddhism. Who's the best teacher? Who is the teacher? Which is his best talks? And it just goes endless and endless. We have terrible arguments and dissension. So it's wonderful, you know, if we could understand that those views which we have are not accurate. They're not reliable. There's a teaching by the Buddha, and this is what I'm talking about. Now, it's a very deep teaching, but a very powerful one, called the vipalasas, the distortions of perception, thoughts, and views. It's why people see things in the wrong way, but they believe they're right. And basically, the Buddha was saying that, you know, in the three characteristics, impermanent, suffering, non-self, he said, the ordinary people, what is impermanent, they see as permanent. What is suffering, they see as happiness. What they see is not self, they see as self. It's only enlightened ones see it the correct way. We see, you know, even this body, sometimes we see it as permanent. Even though it's just so obvious, it's not. There's still some people in this world. Apparently Walt Disney cryogenically froze his brain and his body, thinking that one day in the future, 100 to 100, 300 years, when medical science has advanced, they can unfreeze his body and bring him back to life again. And even so, these days, and doctors say, oh, one day there will be a cure for death. That, you know, you don't have to die, you can live forever. But think about it, would you really want to live forever? Living forever is actually a curse. And when I was a kid, they had a movie of Dracula. This was, you know, before the stupid vampires, which are all over the place these days. But they always called it the thinking man's Dracula, because it wasn't just sex and violence. It was actually had a message to it. That this guy Dracula was actually cursed with immortality. And the only way that he would, you know, die would be to lure out into the sunlight. And the whole movie was about his inner conflict, his fear of dying, but his terrible boredom of living. You know, he'd been there, done it after about 300 or 400 years of life. And he couldn't stand another day, but he was afraid to die. And that conflict was the message of that movie. And it's a wonderful method, because this is also the idea of, like, enlightenment, letting go. The big dying, but then you want to live as well. It's a conflict there. But that was a very beautiful conflict because it did really highlight, you know, the suffering of eternal life. Been there, done that. What more can you do? And it's one of the reasons why, after seeing a movie like that, you really doubted the idea that a permanent eternal heaven realm could ever exist. I often used to fantasize about heaven realm, eternal place where you could be happy ever after, and what would it be like? And when I read the Christian idea of heaven, it was ambrosia. For breakfast, lunch and dinner, day after day after day. After about 6 months, I'd be sick of ambrosia, no matter what it tasted like. And I had harp music. I like rock. Electric guitars, they didn't have anything like that up there. And so, but anyway, just however beautiful and nice it is, after a while you take it for granted and it doesn't sort of affect you anymore. And this is one of the reasons why I remember reading in one Christian theology book that their idea of heaven was, yeah, 364 days a year you had a wonderful time up in heaven, but everybody, every year, had to spend one day in hell. Otherwise they would not appreciate heaven. And that was actually quite a nice little good view, nice understanding. Because if you do have happiness in heaven for all the time, you're just not happy anymore. You do need contrast. Otherwise you just don't know it's happiness. Like even today, if you look at your houses where you live, you know, where you live today, and compare that to the house of a sultan or a king, sort of 200, 300, 400 years ago, and you live a lifestyle better than a king. But, you know, everyone lives the same, so we take it for granted. Look at the food we eat. You know, we eat banquets every day. Look at the entertainment you have on your TV. You can watch anything. Imagine what a king would have to do to get all those dancers and musicians in, and only if you're very rich could you get such entertainment, the best in the world. So, but we're used to this now, and we think it's normal, even though it's incredibly, incredibly heavenly, our modern world. This is one of the reasons why, that if you start to believe that there is such a permanent heaven realm, it just doesn't make any sense. So what you think is happiness and permanence is actually suffering and impermanence. And anyway, those are what the Buddha was saying, but we put it in just the normal ideas that whenever you have a view, any view whatsoever, then you actually interpret the world according to your view. You literally see what you want to see. And you can't see what's true, what you don't like to see. And the most obvious case of that is when two people fall in love. And you know, it's really cute. You maybe have been there. I've been there, you know, before I became a monk. Fortunately, wisdom kicked in before it got too late. But you've been there, and you see your kids and friends fall in love, and it's sweet, but it's so stupid. You know, when the girl thinks, that guy's the most amazing, wonderful person in the world. They're so kind, they're so sweet, they're so sensitive. And you believe that's true. And then later on in the relationship, he's so cool and insensitive and hard. What went wrong? Did he change? Or was he always like that? And I say he was always like that, but you wouldn't see it. You're literally in denial. You don't see what you don't want to see. You only see what you want. And of course, you know, the idea of the romance, the perfect partner, your soulmate, the one who's meant for you, the one who's going to give you happiness ever after. You know, the Prince Charming and the Cinderella, that's all you see. Same with the guys. When you're in love, you just cannot see her pimples. You know, you cannot smell her farts. This is a Buddhist story. It's gross, but it's there in the Buddhist house. There was this man who wanted to become a monk, this boy. And the parents didn't want him to become a monk. You can't be a monk. He said, oh, but I want to become a monk. No, we don't want you. We'll give you anything you want. No, if you don't become a monk. And he saw his chance. He said, really, Mum and Dad? You give me everything I want? Say, yeah, anything you want. No, even a nice girl? Yeah, we get you any girl you like. And if you can't find a girl like that for me, will you let me become a monk? So, yeah, we're rich, you know, we can get you any girl you want. I said, great, I want a girl who doesn't fart. So he became a monk. You're not being gross to girls, boys are the same, we're human beings. But when you fall in love, his wind is so fragrant. The way she picks her nose, it's so charming. But you can see where I'm coming from over here. You bend perception to what you want to believe. And when you go through the separation, the recycling, the divorce, it's amazing. Just that guy is so bad, he's so angry, he's so mean. Yeah, I know that guy. You know, he's got other friends. He's not that bad. He's got that side to him. But that's all you see when you're going through that anger and hatred business. You can't see anything else. It's the same guy. It's the same girl. It's only just our views have changed our perceptions. Bend the perception to see what we want to see, not what's really there. And because we bend perceptions, this is the raw data, the evidence which we build up our thoughts. As soon as you see that he's a bastard, then you start thinking like that. And those thoughts convince your view. And we get this cycle of cognitive distortion. From views, you change perceptions. From perceptions, you justify your thoughts, or you build your thoughts, and the thoughts justify your views. Because I sometimes wonder, why do people have some of these ridiculous ideas of religion? And then these are sometimes very, very smart people. You know, there was this Heaven's Gate some years ago. This is just one out of many weird cults which arise from time to time. These were all professional people with good education, who were convinced that when a meteor was coming to Earth, there was a spaceship traveling behind it, and that they would all be saved if they were part of this cult. And the only way to get onto that spaceship, you know, was just before the meteor hit Earth, would actually pass it a long way away, was actually to commit suicide, and then they would go and reborn onto the spaceship. So that all these people were committing suicide. And you think that's crazy. But then you say, what are you doing, spending a whole 8 days on this retreat when you could be enjoying yourself? You could be watching the TV. You could be actually eating a dinner tonight. What are you doing this for? But sometimes you really doubt when you hear some extreme cases like that. What am I doing? So how can you trust your views and ideas and perceptions? What actually is right view? And why is it that so many people argue and catch some stupid views? And these are so-called highly intelligent, educated people getting ridiculous views. Why? And you can see that the whole purpose, or the whole crux of this, from views, perceptions, thoughts, and then back to views again, is you perceive what you want to see. And you can't see what you don't want to see. It's that wanting, the craving, ill will. That is what bends perceptions and creates wrong view. So this is one of the problems. There was these great psychology experiments. They're always done every now and again. And this particular one was done at Harvard. They had a group of students, and they flashed images from the campus on a screen. And they had a notepad, and they could, when they thought they knew what it was, then they could note it down. But the images were flashed so fast, you know, you couldn't really see what it was there. And then they increased the exposure, you know, from a tenth of a second to 0.2 seconds, until they could actually get some idea what it was. And they wanted to find out how much exposure was necessary to actually to get an accurate description of what they were seeing. And what they found out, which was unexpected, that when it was an unpleasant, a gross image, it always took them much longer to see what it truly was. If it was, you know, a picture of, say, like flowers in a garden, it's a beautiful, they got that very quickly. But when it became two dogs copulating, that took them forever to see that, because it was what they didn't want to see. Flowers in a garden is what they want to see. It's amazing just seeing just how we bend our perceptions and thoughts. So, Dhamma, the truth, right view, sometimes is things which quite challenge us, which make us quite afraid. And you come across fear in your meditation. I don't want to see this. This can't be true. But maybe it is true. So the only way to get right view and to be clear that it is right view and you're not getting this wrong view and misunderstandings again is you have to let go of all your wants and ill will. So you're experiencing not what you want to experience, but you experience what is there. And you're not denying what is unpleasant and nasty, but anything you will actually accept. And this is one of the difficulties. Especially if you have a view and it's wrong. How hard is it to admit, I was wrong? And if that's really hard to admit that you are wrong, that's just a sign you've got a big ego. There's nothing wrong with being wrong. In fact, there's everything right with being wrong. You're a human being. You make mistakes. It's okay to be an idiot. Which is one of the reasons why whenever you do anything stupid, whenever you do anything wrong, you never get scolded in Buddhism. You just get laughed at. I love this when people do stupid things. When they do a stupid thing, it makes everybody happy. It's true. Because every time I do a stupid thing, I make a mistake, I tell everybody about it. And some of the stupid things I've done have caused so much happiness and merriment in all the talks which I have given. Probably one of the most popular wrong things I did, because people keep reminding me of it, was that time when I was very tired. And I was doing a marriage ceremony. And in the marriage ceremony, I was doing the chanting, but I did the wrong chanting. I did the chanting for the funerals. It's supposed to be a marriage, and I did the funeral chanting. And of course, they never knew anything about it, because it's in Pali, and no one knows. That's one of the advantages in chanting in a language no one knows anything about. So when we do the chanting in the morning and the evening, you say, why can't we do this in English? If we did all of our chanting in English, you'll always know when me, monks and nuns make mistakes, then we'd be in big trouble, because it's more often than you think. Especially when we're doing a marriage and we do the funeral chant. But the amazing thing is that couple is still together. They're happily married. So yeah, I make mistakes. One of the other great mistakes I made, and it changed. It was just a funeral again. It was at a funeral ceremony, and it was a Sri Lankan man. And he comes to the temple, comes regularly, and he said, oh, you know, someone has died in my family. Can you come and do the ceremony for us? And so I went along there, and, he did tell me the name, but it was like a long Sri Lankan name, and I really didn't know exactly who it was. So when I went there and got up on the lectern and welcomed everybody and say, we're here today to do a Buddhist funeral ceremony for, I knew my disciple's name, for his mother who's just passed away. And that's when this old lady stood up at the front. It's not me who's dead, it's my husband. It's a 50-50 chance that I chose the wrong one. Sometimes it does happen, sometimes you have those days. But that was the most funny funeral, because once she got up and said that, oh, it's just a wonderful funeral, which I'll always remember, it just changed the whole atmosphere. No more somber people giggling and laughing all over the place. So that's what happens when we make mistakes. We laugh at it, so we don't get so afraid of getting it wrong. And if you allow yourself to make mistakes, you don't make so many. If you're really afraid of making mistakes, you make heaps. So if you do make a mistake, one of the things which I was taught is actually I was taught at the psychology class of being a school teacher. There's a very, very nice little saying. If you make a mistake, and you know, the children in the class, if they start laughing, then you laugh as well as the teacher. Then the world never laughs at you. It only laughs with you. I love that saying. So, you know, I continue to make mistakes, say stupid things. So, you know, when I say something stupid and you start laughing, it's a great excuse for me to laugh as well. And that word means you never laugh at me. No one ever laughs at me. They only laugh with me. And I enjoy my stupidity as well. Which means, you know, you're not carrying such a heavy ego and having to be right and having to be perfect all the time. If you want to be perfect, oh, you go to hell. People who try to be perfect. People who are quite happy with who they are, at peace with who they are, who have compassion and contentment, then you never go to those hell realms, either in this life or in the next life. You're happy, you're at peace, content. So, if there is a heaven, it's not made of perfect people. It's made of people just like you, who are happy to be imperfect. That is the secret of happiness. But anyway, so here we go. All of our views which we argue with. If we have ill will, we won't see what's really there. If we have desire, we want to just confirm what we already know to prove that we are right. Again, you will never find any truth. Which is one of the reasons why when we talk about the five hindrances in Buddhism, starts off with desire and ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. It's not only things which stop you getting into jhanas, it's also things which stop you seeing the truth of things. If you have desire, it means wanting. It means you don't see what's out there, you see what you want to see. If you have ill will, again, you don't see the truth. You know, if it's not what you want to see, if it's ugly or if it's challenging, you have ill will. It blocks the truth out. The same restlessness, you're not here long enough to see the truth. And sloth and torpor, you're too dull to see what's happening. And doubt, again, doubt is another form of restlessness. But when those hindrances are gone, then what you see, you can trust. That's the answer to the question, how do you know that your view is the right view? How can you trust it? Because so many times people think they're right and it turns out they're wrong. So many people argue who's right and who's wrong, which is the right religion, which is the right truth, which is the right part of this religion. And these are people who, you know, look like they know what they're talking about. They have got good reputations, they're admirable. So which one will you trust? Yeah, you can follow them around and see if what they say is what they do, whether they walk the talk. Which always reminds me of this time I was in Singapore and I had a free morning, and the abbot of the Buddhist library was, who was the abbot of the Buddhist, Dhammaratana. Yeah, Venerable Dhammaratana, he was the head of the Buddhist library. He brought this new place in Geylang, and he owed a lot of money to the bank. So he bought it at the height of the building boom, and then the economy went down. So, you know, sometimes monks are not smart, but, you know, they got other ways of dealing with these problems. And he was raising funds all over the place, and he was having a charity walk. And I had a free morning, so I said, oh, I'll join in, help another monk. So I went there with a few people from the Buddhist Fellowship, you know, get some support. And it was just on the spur of the moment. I wasn't expected. And so he was so happy to see me. Hi, Ajahn Brahm. Thank you for coming to my fundraiser. And of course, because I was well known, I also had to give a talk. So, you know, I went and gave a little talk, you know, about raising funds, trying to encourage people. And then I had one of the ministers in the government. He was also there. I forget what his name was. He's not in the government anymore. I think he retired. One of the ministers was there, and he gave his talk about, you know, lovely to support this centre or whatever. And then I asked him, you know, just at the end of his talk, he said, you know, are you going to come for a walk with us? And he said, no, I only talk the walk. I don't walk the talk. Really nice joke, you know, for a politician. And so you can check out whether your monks and your teachers, your nuns are walking the talk. But even that, you don't really know whether what they're saying is the truth. You know, because sometimes you may say these things and maybe it is the truth, but you don't understand it and you misinterpret it and you get it all wrong. You know, that's not what I really meant. It's like Ajahn Chah. Sometimes he would tell people, he said, you know, when I see someone leading to the left, I tell them to go to the right. When they're leaning to the right, I tell them to go to the left. And they think I'm contradicting myself. And it's just because they don't understand just, you know, where I'm coming from, what I'm saying. So even if you've got a great teacher, sometimes you don't know whether what they say is right or whether you understood them or not. So the only way you can trust things is if all these qualities called the hindrances, which stop you seeing things truly, have vanished. You've got no desire in you, no wanting at all. You don't want to see the truth. Otherwise you will never see it. You will bend it. You don't want to confirm whatever you already know. You are courageous enough to see things even you don't expect. And you have no vested interest in proving your rights. That's more wanting. And ill will if what is right in front of you sort of is telling you you're wrong. And you have this great courage. If you want to see the truth, you have the courage to see things you never expected and see things which challenge you to the core. And I think that's the hardest of the hindrances to overcome, to actually to see the truth, ill will. Because it's sometimes the truth challenges you. It's not what you expect. It shocks you. I have this little simile which I developed of the driverless bus. What its life is like being in a bus. It's your life. And sometimes your bus goes into very beautiful territory. Rolling hills and waterfalls and gardens and meadows. It's just so beautiful. You're having a good time in life. But whenever you look out of the window from your bus and it's very beautiful outside, your bus driver tends to accelerate. And it doesn't last as long as it should. In this simile, when you have happy times, beautiful times, why is it doesn't last as long as it should? And then you go into ugly, disgusting, frightening territory, like the bus going through the toxic nuclear waste dumps of life. And you look through the window and it's disgusting, it's terrible. And what does your bus driver do? Slows down and even stops and parks. Why is it the pain of life, the difficulties and the hard parts of life, why do they last longer than they should? And this is actually a simile for life. So we come here to try and teach our bus driver to be smart. Having a wonderful life, a wonderful time, a happy time, come and slow down. Be mindful. Enjoy it. Enjoy this last day of the retreat. What happens? It goes really fast. And when you're having a terrible time, you know, you got sick. Or late this evening, you can't go to sleep at night because you've got a cold. Or 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, you're still not asleep. Why is this happening to me? Because the terrible times, the painful times last longer than normal. So you try to teach yourself. How can I, teach me how I can go to sleep at night without all these problems. Teach me how to deal with the difficulties of life, like husbands, like nagging wives, like kids who don't do what they're told, like bosses from hell, like diseases and sicknesses. Tell me how to deal with this, because I want to get out of here quickly and have a happy life. And that is a simile of trying to teach the bus driver how to drive his bus. So, in order to, this is what you come here for, to be wiser in your decision making. But what happens? What happens before you can teach the bus driver? You've got to go to the bus driver's seat and find the bus driver, get close enough to teach him or her. And this is what this meditation does. to go to the bus driver's seat. Who is this person managing your life? Who is this emperor? What is this thing deep inside of you which controls everything? This stupid thing inside of you always makes mistakes, so you think. And this is what you do with the meditation. You go deep, 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 deep inside until you find your bus driver's seat, the one at the controls of your life, the one who makes all these decisions so you can teach him or her or it how to be more smart. And when you find that bus driver's seat, this is where you see something which is actually quite disturbing. This is why if you have any remnants of ill will, you cannot see this. It's just too tough to see. It's just too challenging for you. You see that the bus driver's seat is empty. As Ajahn Chah said, there's nothing. There's no one there. There's no one driving your bus. Ah! But you can't deny that. It's not what you expect. It's not what you want. But when you see it, it has huge consequences. And the consequences are, after you see there's no bus driver in your bus, you go back to your seat, you sit down, and you shut up. A waste of time complaining. There's no one to complain to, which is the end of desire and ill will. No more complaining. There's no one to complain to. So stop complaining about yourself and all of your faults, all of your silly idiosyncrasies, all of your bad jokes. I don't complain about my bad jokes. No one to. I looked inside. Whose fault is this? I can't find anyone inside of myself who tells bad jokes. That's just thinking of a new bad joke. I don't know if I should tell this. Actually, how many of you come from locals in Australia? Okay, you'll get this joke. it's only a new one somebody sent me. If you're not Australian, I'll have to explain it afterwards. But this was a guy who went to McDonald's, and the girl serving him in the restaurant was wearing a burqa. And the burqa was really dirty and grubby and torn, and it really put him off. So he didn't buy anything in McDonald's from this person with this really dirty burqa. So he went over the road to Hungry Jack's. I think that's Hungry Jack's is like Burger King in other countries. So he went into Hungry Jack's. And there he saw another woman serving him. And she was also wearing a burqa. But her burqa was really clean and nice and fresh and beautiful. And he went, of course, because the burqas are always better in Hungry Jack's. Okay, a few people are holding their heads in dismay. Now, that is the slogan of like Burger King or Hungry Jack's over in Australia. The burgers are better in Hungry Jack's, but this is the burkas. Okay, that's a terrible, terrible, terrible joke. But yeah, waste of time complaining to me, because there's no one in here to complain. My bus driver's seat is totally empty, so not my fault. So what it means, you can enjoy your life rather than getting angry and ill will. That's where all the sort of the desire and ill will start to disappear. And also you start to get right view. Because there's nothing to bend your views anymore. So the main part of this is to say you can't trust your views until at least you've seen non-self and overcome all your desires and ill will. Otherwise, you'll always be bending the truth. You'll always be seeing someone say, oh, I like her. And you're not seeing her bad parts. I don't like him. And you're not seeing his beautiful parts. It's amazing that why people get upset and angry at people. Some people have their enemies. And, you know, I tell people, that's your enemy. But you know, that enemy of yours, you know, they've got many, many friends. And those friends, they can see something beautiful in that person. Why can't you? It's one of the ways we overcome that anger and that wanting to have revenge on somebody. You have to go and see something beautiful in that person before you overcome the anger. And then when you see something beautiful in them, you can't actually have that view if they're a bad person anymore. That's why you tell a person to do the old technique, get out a sheet of paper, write a line right down the middle, put the name of your enemy on the top, and on the left-hand side, put all the reasons why you hate them, why they're a terrible person, why they're selfish, mean, nasty, which is very easy to fill up that left-hand side of the piece of paper. And once you've filled in the left-hand side of the piece of paper justifying your anger at your enemy, then on the right-hand side you have to put nice things about them, things you admire and respect about them, which is much more difficult. The first entry is always the most difficult. But once you've got the first entry down there, then you can get the second one is much quicker, the third one is easy, and soon you've filled out the whole right-hand side of the paper. You stop that distortion of your view. You're totally looking for another side of them, and you can find it. Now, once you have that other side filled in, then if that's your enemy, you cut that piece of paper down the middle, and the side with all the negative parts about them goes in the trash can. And you keep the side which shows all the beautiful things of them, the things you can respect about them, their kindness. And that changes your whole attitude towards them. You can't get angry at them when you realize actually there's so many good things about them. And then you change your view. And then you can do that to yourself. So many people have a lack of self-esteem, think they're awful, think they're hopeless, think they're a bad person. You do that to yourself. And I've sat down and done this with people. Get the piece of paper out, line down the middle, your name on the top, left-hand side, all the reasons why you are hopeless, useless, good for nothing, waste of time, and all the reasons why you should be depressed about yourself. And they put that down on the left-hand side, which is so easy for them to do. The right-hand side, things which are nice about yourself. I remember doing this with one guy recently. He said, there's nothing nice about myself, nothing at all. There must be something good. I said, nope. They said, well, have you got a cat? Well, yeah. Did you feed it this morning? Yeah. Put it down. Fed the cat. And then once you got the crack in the wall, you have all these other things came down. And this guy filled out the rest of the sheet of paper. And I tore it out down the middle for him, gave him the nice part of himself. And that really changed his life. He realizes actually he's not such a bad guy after all. You can see how just this ill will and craving can actually just distort the truth. And this is actually why, if you really want to find the truth, don't just believe your views, your ideas, when there's ill will or craving there. Our job is to overcome that first, which is one of the reasons why we really do need the stillness, because the stillness, the samadhi, that's a sign that you have overcome those hindrances. It proves to you there's no ill will, there is no craving there, because the mind is perfectly still. And once our mind is perfectly still, and then, at least nimittas, probably the jhanas and after the jhanas, only then can you really trust that what you see afterwards is not distorted, can be trusted. Which is why wisdom, the wisdom you can rely upon, always arises from silence, from stillness. Because that's the only place these five hindrances are certain to be absent. Everything else you can't tell is true or not. Which is one of the reasons why I was talking yesterday about psychic powers. If you have any visions, if you have any premonitions, if you have any series of numbers for the lottery in deep meditation before you get into jhanas, don't trust them. They could be wrong. Because previous to these deep meditations, you can't trust anything. It could be a distortion of your perception. But if it happens afterwards, after jhanas, you can trust that. Because there's no greed, no desire, and nothing to trust, nothing to distort what you're actually seeing. One of the reasons why that when people do develop psychic stuff, pre-jhana, leave it alone. Post-jhana, okay. And also about these pre-jhanas and post-jhanas. Even pre-jhanas, you remember your past lives. Most times it could be okay, but you never really know that it's true until post-jhana. Post-jhana, absolutely certain what you see is real, because you're not distorting the truth. You're not playing around. The desire and ill will which change the truth to fit what you want to see is no longer there. So that is where you can be totally safe. But in one of the sutras, the Buddha said a very, very interesting thing, which is an obstacle to getting deep meditation. Because when you get into, you know, say, nimitta stage, your mind is very clear and powerful. And you find that you can actually think so clearly. You can get a train of thought and actually follow it. It's actually focused and clear. Most time when people think, they think all over the place. You know, you're going on one subject, then you go off on a tangent, then you go somewhere else, just like my talks. All sorts of stuff comes up. But when you actually get into deep meditation, you really can think in a straight line. Your thinking is powerful. And as many people, you know, before they get into the jhanas, you know, when they get really, really still, they get into such a good, powerful state of mind, they start thinking about Dhamma. And they really believe that what they can see at that stage is going to be the truth. And a lot of people get deceived in that state. So much so that the Buddha actually pointed it out, that that is an obstacle to wisdom, to enlightenment. Dhamma vitakka, thinking about the Dhamma. And when I pointed that out to a few monks, they said, it can't be the case. Thinking about the Dhamma must always be okay. And the answer was no. It's not yet ready. Your mind is not pure enough. And what you think is not going to be what is true. You're only going to see what you want to see, not what is true Dhamma. So even at that stage, you have to let go of all thinking and be perfectly still. When you emerge after the jhanas, then that's the time where insight arises, not before. The Buddha called that the lingering obstacle, when all the other hindrances are gone. The last obstacle before jhana. Working it all out. Thinking about the truth. That's not the right view. So really, you do get all sorts of little half-right views, enough to actually to understand how to get down the mountain by following the stream. You can feel a little bit of peace, a little bit of happiness, but you're not really so sure what peace and happiness are. Sometimes you get the wrong type of peace, the wrong type of happiness. And then you go down, 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 down eventually, and then when you do get the stillness, and what comes afterwards is not distorted anymore. It's a simile which I gave at the very beginning of this retreat. The simile of the lake. When there's any waves on that lake at all, when it's yet to be still, you will never see a perfect image of the moon and stars in the sky at night. But when it's perfectly still, when it's not a ripple, then it's like the glass mirror. You can look above and you can see perfect reflections. Or to borrow the simile of the Buddha, you can stand above it, just lean above it. Because it's perfectly still, you can see right down to the very bottom of the lake. See the fish, maybe the few plants, and the gravel on the bed of the lake. Only when it's perfectly still. And when it's still, all of the muck, the mud, all settles down on the bottom. So you can see right through it. Just like the mind. This is the Buddha simile. When the mind is still, all the muck, all the defilements, they settle. So you can see right through to the very bottom of the lake, which is called you. And that's actually how we get the right view. So the answer to the question was, basically, you have to be still before you get right view. Real right view, which you can trust is not distorted. Before then, it can always deceive you, as it's deceived many people. And the last little story is when I was deceived. Because sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, are you enlightened? And I like telling people the time when I was enlightened. It's one of my lovely stories. 4 years I had been a monk in Thailand. And I was in this monastery in the northeast of Thailand, just in Roi Et province, north of Saelapum, south of, Bu or something. Anyway, around that area. It was a very simple monastery, and I was having some great meditation. And one evening, I was just meditating, getting really high in very deep states, and having no hindrances at all, and I was walking meditation. People ask, can you get enlightened on walking meditation? Yeah, you can. Because I had all these great insights coming. When it really starts to flow, you get insight after insight, things you've never seen before. You can't understand these things when your mind is agitated. And these things which, wow, I never understood that before. Now it all makes sense. You can't chase these things. They come to you, just like in that story. If you sit under the Bodhi tree, perfectly still, hold out your hand, all these mangoes fall. All these mangoes were falling, one after the other. It was late at night, maybe 11, 12 o'clock at night. And then the big one fell. A real big one. Wow, this is it. Enlightened. Arahat. Fully. Wow. That was such a wonderful experience. It's just a shame it didn't last that long. And there I was, the enlightened Western monk in northeast Thailand. And it's such a beautiful state, just perfectly happy, blissed out, not wanting anything in the world. And it was 1 o'clock in the morning, just absolutely no tiredness at all. Just perfect, poised mindfulness. You want to point it on anything, it will just go there straight away. Watch the breath, it just stays there. And it got to about 2 o'clock. We used to get up at 3 o'clock, got about 2 o'clock. I just thought I should go to bed. So I lay down, half an hour later, I was up again. You know what it's like when you get nice meditation? You go around your room, you can't sleep, you don't need to sleep. And so I was back there in the hall, meditating there when they rang the bell at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was already meditating, blissing out. I have beautiful meditation. This was in the jungles, okay, so this is really hot, rains retreat, really humid, lots of mosquitoes, and just, it's so in the jungle, so close air, it's obvious that people get sleepy, but not that morning. That morning, perfect posture. If you push me, I wouldn't fall over. I was just so strong. And when you get the chant, you know the chanting we do here? Okay, I'm an old monk. Old monks aren't supposed to chant. No, singing is for young people. But anyway, sometimes you chant out of key. Sometimes you chant this way and that way. But this morning, my chanting was perfect. Really strong and sonorous. I'd be able to give Pavarotti a run for his money that morning. Beautiful chanting. And I was enlightened, I was arahat, so it was easy to do anything. And then he went on our arms round. And as I went on the arms round, every person who put rice in my bowl, I think, you lucky things. You have just given your rice to a new arahat. The great blessings, and you don't know this. And so I was giving this incredible loving kindness to all the people who put food into my bowl. And then after the arms round, just like floating on air, loving kindness to all beings, even the dogs, you came back into the monastery. Now, usually, every day, we'd have the same food, which was rotten fish curry, pradek. Now that rotten fish, to understand what it was, they catch the fish in the paddy fields during the rains retreats. And that was basically their whole source of protein. So they'd catch lots at that time, and they'd eat, the fresh stuff, and they'd put all the other stuff into a jar to pickle it. But, their pickling process was unhygienic, and it was disgusting. Because, on another occasion, I found one of those jars, with the old fish from about 6 or 7 months ago, and they just put a bit of plastic on the top of the jar, to seal it, but the plastic had broken and the flies had got in and it was crawling with maggots. And so I picked it up to throw it away. But before I could throw it away, the head man of the village, he was the most educated, the most sophisticated. He saw me, he said, what are you doing? I said, look, it's gone off, it's got magazine. He said, no, give it to me, that's more protein. And that's what we ate the following morning. And as it sounded, it smelled even worse. Honestly, it just had this really terrible, pungent smell. And that's what he ate every morning. But the morning of my enlightenment, there was another pot, as well as the rotten fish curry. And it was actually a pork curry. No, this is what they eat. You couldn't be vegetarian because you eat what they eat. And it was a pork curry. And that was actually edible. You know, that was actually, you know, just had a taste which most people, I'm not just saying Westerners, even Sri Lankans, you would not be able to take that Northeast food. Even people in Bangkok couldn't take it. They hated that stuff, let alone Westerners. But that was actually pork curry. It was actually edible. And so I thought straight away, as soon as I saw that, I said, wow, amazing. The heavenly beings were celebrating my enlightenment. By, you know, like, you know, it's a birthday, get a cake. My enlightenment, they get a pork curry. But wow, even the heavenly beings know the truth. A new arahat has appeared in the world. And so there I was number two monk, had the head monk. And, you know, he just gave the blessing. And it was only about 6 months in this monastery, so, you know, we'd actually help ourselves. You know, just pass the pots down. And so he took, he wouldn't believe how much of this pork curry he took. No one could eat that much, even 3 days. A huge amount, but there's plenty left for me, so I didn't really mind. But what he did next, was beyond the pale. He picked up the pork curry. He'd already taken his stuff, okay. Picked up the pork curry and poured it into the rotten fish curry. Stirred it all up, saying, it's all the same, it's all the same. And I, if it was all the same, why didn't you mix it before you took yours? You hypocrite. And now you spoil my enlightenment lunch. And I'm not stepped. And that's when it hit me. Enlightened people don't get angry. They don't care what they eat. And that's when I realized I wasn't enlightened after all. And you know, if ever you think about getting depressed, that's the most depressed you can ever get. When you think you're enlightened and you find you ain't. That ruined the rest of the whole retreat. I, from that time on, I didn't care what I ate. Just bunged it in and just passed it down. I was just really upset. It was nice when it lasted, though, I must admit. So that was a time when I was enlightened and when I was unenlightened afterwards. It was just a fake. It was just not the real thing. And so you've got to be really careful there. Sometimes, you know, people who think they're enlightened and then, you know, they find out they're not. So this is where you've got to be concerned about your views. Any craving, any ill will bends the truth. So you see what you want to see, you don't see what's truly there. That's why these jhanas are really, really important. That is why actually the truth is, you have to be so still before you get right view. Before then, it's just a bit of hit and miss. So don't always trust a teacher like me, or trust the books. They may have a very good teacher, you may have the Buddha in front of you, but nevertheless, maybe you don't understand it. Maybe you cherry pick what's been said. The part you like, you agree with, that's what you remember. The part you disagree with, you reject. That's the problem. And the only way to overcome that, little by little, keep on meditating, getting more and more still, more and more blissed out. Blissing out is a sign it's happening. See those nimittas, get the jhanas, and afterwards when you emerge, then whatever arises then, that you can trust. That is right view. Before they've pretty much hit and miss. So there we go. There's the answer to why people argue, and why there's so many forms of Buddhism. Why there's many forms of Theravada Buddhism. Why there's many forms of forest Buddhism. Why there's many forms of Buddhism even in Bodhinyana Monastery. But there's only one right view. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good.